It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up after following a group of millennials through their college years and beyond, a group of researchers are using the data to better meet the needs of today's young adults. We'll talk to a UW-Madison professor about what they learned. First, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled today that in most cases, law enforcement can't track someone past locations through their cell phone without a warrant. Chief Justice John Roberts joined the court's liberal justices in the 5-4 decision. Digital privacy advocates are praising the ruling, but the case leaves open questions about real-time surveillance and when third-party companies have to surrender information we've given them. Blake Reed is an associate clinical professor at the University of Colorado Law School. He teaches the intersection of law, policy, and technology. He's the director of the Samuelson Glushko Technology Law and Policy Clinic. Blake, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob. Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
To start, can you give us the basics of the particular case that brought this issue to the court?
So this particular case is about historical cell information. So in the context, somebody committed a crime, and the police wanted to be able to, or it's actually a series of burglaries, and the police wanted to be able to track their location information to corroborate that they'd been in the approximate locations of the burglaries. And so they went to the cell phone company and said, hey, can we get the cell phone records, those cell phone location information records for this person, because that will tell us where they were at these particular times. And of course, the officers didn't get a warrant. They got a lesser standard. It's called a 2703D order, and a magistrate judge approved it, and the phone companies turned the information over, and he was convicted. And his defense attorneys argued that the officer should have gotten a warrant, and that's what led to the basics of the case.
And slicing and dicing here a little bit, if the police wanted, say, to search my house, they would generally need a warrant to do that. But this is third-party data. I have, in effect, voluntarily given my cell phone location information to the cell phone company, and legally that's been treated as a different thing, right?
Well, so that's the whole question that the court is grappling with here, right? So you're exactly right. The Fourth Amendment says that we're secure in our persons and our records and effects, and the Supreme Court has primarily read that to be about our houses, so the cops can't come knock your door down and start rifling through your stuff without establishing probable cause and getting a warrant for a judge. But here the question is, you are leaving in the hands of your cell phone company as you drive around, as you go from to work, to school, out to eat, to go to your doctor's office. Maybe go more sensitive locations, go to your therapist's office, that sort of thing. You are turning over on a very regular basis your location to your cell phone company for the purpose of them being able to deliver calls to you. And so they keep those records. And so the question is, are you waiving your rights to privacy in that information because you turn it over to a third party? And there are a series of older Supreme Court cases dating back to the 1970s that say anytime you turn over information to a third party, whether that's banking information or in the context of using a landline phone, the numbers that you dial, you turn those over to the phone company. And the court have found there's this doctrine called the third party doctrine. And when you turn any information over to a third party, you waive your reasonable expectation of privacy, and the cops don't need a warrant for that. With a lot of categories of information, Congress has stepped in and said, no, we do need a warrant, or maybe we even need a higher standard than a warrant for certain types of information. But it hasn't been clear how that would work with cell phone location information. And so this case confronted that question more directly.
Talking to Blake Reed from the University of Colorado Law School about this U.S. Supreme Court ruling out this morning on how police can and can't use your cell phone location data. They need a warrant, the majority says. Let's get into that ruling now. Chief Justice Roberts departed from his fellow conservatives, went with the liberals to get a majority here. What was their argument about why this cell phone location data might be different than what's come up in past cases?
Well, there's a so in addition to the third party doctrine, there's this line of cases around surveilling you in public. And there's a case where the cops attached a GPS tracker to someone's car and followed him around for several months and basically were able to get precise location information about where he was. And so there have been cases before where the cops had less sophisticated surveillance technology and they said, well, that's okay. You're out in public. You're opening up the possibility that the cops can track you. But with this GPS case, they said, well, you have a reasonable expectation that you're not going to be followed around 24/7 for weeks or months on end. And so that violates your reasonable expectation of privacy. And so that reasonable expectation and not being surveilled all the time runs headlong into the third party doctrine here, because your cell phone company is basically surveilling you all the time. They have location information on you all the time, but they're a third party and you voluntarily turn information over to them, or at least that's the argument that the government made. And so the majority, in considering these two doctrines, said, look, technology has changed a lot. Everybody has a cell phone. This is almost an involuntary part of being a productive member of society. You've got to be able to carry a cell phone around. And if that means that the cell phone company has your location information, well, we can't infer that you don't have any privacy against the government as to being surveilled all the time. So that's sort of how the majority arrived at its conclusion. It said the interest in not being surveilled 24/7 outweighs the fact that you turn the information over to a third party.
Now, in the dissent, the other four justices, the conservatives, apart from Chief Justice Roberts, they seemed very emphatic in their opposition to this decision. What were their main lines of argument?
Yeah, there are four different dissents, which is a little bit of an unusual configuration. Several of them agreeing with each other, but they had a few different lines of attack. One of them was that we traditionally have recognized Fourth Amendment protections in things that are your property, so your home, for example, or your papers, and it's a little bit unclear that data about you is property. So the dissents grapple a lot with this idea about whether information that that your cell phone company holds on to about you is your property, and they spend a lot of time arguing about that. There also was a really interesting section of Justice Gorsuch's dissent where he goes back and attacks the third-party doctrine pretty directly, and you can tell he's pretty unhappy with the reasoning behind the third-party doctrine. So I think a lot of people are puzzling over whether his dissent might have put him in the camp of the majority, if the majority had been willing to go a little bit further, or if it would have put him in the camp of the other dissenting justices. The other dissenting justices were also obviously concerned about the impact this is going to have on law enforcement, right? This is obviously a useful tool for law enforcement to be able to figure out where people have been, to sort of reconstruct, go back in a time machine, reconstruct where people have been. But in any case, those arguments didn't win the day. And so now I think people are just looking forward to the line of cases that are no doubt going to arise out of this one.
Right. What's next then? Does this set precedent for other types of surveillance, other types of our technology and data potentially being used against us?
Absolutely. So there are some obvious cases that will no doubt be tested in the coming months and years. So this case was just about historical cell site data, so data the phone company holds on to about you. There'll be cases about real-time location tracking, whether the cops can go to the phone company and get your information in real time and say, hey, we want to know where Rob is right now. There'll be interesting questions about Stingray devices, which are cops use to surveil phone communications. They're sort of simulated cell site towers that they pretend to be the phone company, but in reality, they can listen in to what you're saying. So this opens up interesting questions there. It'll bring up cases about facial recognition and the companies like Facebook that hold on to huge volumes of data about what your face looks like in the form of images. And then it'll open up a whole slew of questions about the ability for authorities to just get information about your data in general. general. And the majority opinion sort of suggests the court is going to take an incremental case-by-case approach to this. They tried to be very measured in how far they were going to go. So I think the message is we are going to see a lot of cases about our digital privacy as to just about every kind of data you can imagine over the coming months and years.
Blake, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. Appreciate it. Have a good weekend.
You too. That's Blake Reed, Associate Clinical Professor at the University of Colorado School of Law. He was with us today to talk about the U.S. Supreme Court ruling that came down this morning saying warrants are needed to track the location of someone's cell phone in most cases. Right now, each generation grows up in a different environment, political, cultural, and with their own set of impactful events. Our next guest was interested in finding out more about what drives the young adults coming of age in today's environment. To do that, she and her colleagues spent 8 years so far surveying millennial-aged participants starting in their freshman year of college. They were asked about financial knowledge, jobs and money, and about the relationships in their lives. Soyeon Shim is dean and the Ted Kellner Baskin Professor in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. She was the co-principal investigator on this study called A+. Soyeon, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what is it you were trying to find out when you kicked off this research, what, 8 years ago?
Yeah, about 10 years ago, there were a lot of issues related to college students getting into trouble with the credit cards. And I was beginning to think, why some do better than others? Where do positive financial behaviors come from, or negative? And I was curious about that. And the really only way to find out is to conduct a longitudinal study following people over a long period of time.
And so you started out asking them what kind of questions in their freshman year of college?
Sure. Freshman first year, we were very curious about what they done, learned while they are growing up at home. So a lot of questions about their perception of their parents, whether their role model behaviors or direct teaching, financial communication, all of this, or whether they took any classes related to money management. So we learned a lot about their background.
And as they age, then, you follow them every couple few years after
Correct.
Which makes this interesting and kind of a unique study.
Exactly. And so first, life success, we define them at the life success at different stage of their life. So when you're freshman, sophomore, we want them to be staying in college and academically doing well. So academic success and social relationship and physical well-being and psychological well-being, those are considered to be a success for outcome. And when they are juniors, seniors, they are looking for a job and looking for graduating, obviously, from college. So all of that, we found different measure of life outcome at different stage of their lives.
Was there anything in that initial group that now looking back, you say, okay, this was a signal, the people who thought this or did this are looking pretty good right now?
Yeah, I think one thing that we noticed that the biggest factor for positive financial behavior that is linked to feeling good about themselves and doing very well was actually what I call financial parenting. And it's very simple, but actually no one used that term, in scientific term. That is the financial, what parents doing at home, knowingly, not knowingly. So it's a perception that children have of parents' behavior. And also parents' direct teaching. To what extent parents really made an effort to teach them about money management. And then financial communication. How much do they talk about money in general, especially when they are in college? You know, often we think that kids are going to college, they're on their own. And it wasn't so. Actually, the positive communication is very important. And finally, financial expectation, parental expectation. Students do better when parents expect them to do better. So we found that students try to strive to meet their parents' expectations. So I think the biggest finding earlier was that financial parenting was the biggest factor for student financial well-being, and that lead to life success.
I want to key in on that because it sounds like this is one maybe of the take-home lessons that parents out there listening right now might use with their kids. Don't assume that kids are going to naturally learn about money out on the street.
Correct. Especially during the first year, this is most of students the first time away from home. And this is the time that they're going to exercise what they sort of learned we call that socialization, anticipatory socialization. So they learned all of that, how to become a consumer, so to speak, while they're growing up. And it's first time they're exercising that behavior. And this is also an opportunity to teach them, also making sure that they don't get into trouble and what are the ways to navigate loans and paying bills, staying on top of their financial accounts and all of that, and also academic success.
And as the students move along, there's a phrase, I think it was financial efficacy. Is
yes.
that right?
Mm-hmm.
This is huge. This
it's
is
huge.
What is this?
Yeah, financial self-efficacy is the one's confidence in managing or performing the financial task. And that ranges from as simple as budgeting, for instance, to managing their money and sticking to the plan and even saving and thinking long-term. All of that, they're one's belief in their ability. And that is very important, an important predictor of their well-being.
And if I'm reading your report right, this is important. This helps no matter what socioeconomic level that student is at or where they are. If they're making lots of money, if they're not making lots of money, sure, their lives are different.
Correct.
But the more self-efficacy, the confidence...
Exactly.
The better off they're going to be.
Absolutely. I think the self-efficacy in general in everything is important, but particularly this financial self-efficacy. They think they can do this, they believe in themselves, and they know how to look for information. They're teaching themselves, learning from others, and that's important.
And you kind of had an unintentional experiment here because right off the bat, we had this great recession, the downturn in 2008.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
And these students were coming out into the job market where it would be very easy to not feel very confident.
Correct. In fact, it's interesting. Some of the characteristics our millennial in this study exhibit is somewhat similar to those who went through Great Depression because they went through this earthquake in their fresh sophomore year. First year was great. Everybody has having a positive experience, but the market crashed. And when they are graduating, either they are delaying their graduation because of their parents lost their homes or couldn't find a job. So they went through a really difficult time, 2008, 9, 10-ish. So they still have this sort of a skepticism whether I'm going to be okay or not.
Talking to Soyeon Shim from the UW-Madison, co-investigator on this study we're talking about called A+, tracking millennials from their freshman year of college on to today and finding out how they're doing when it comes to especially their financial well-being. And Soyeon, you, as you followed up with these students and as you tracked them, mm-hmm. you looked at people from different backgrounds.
Correct.
And I want to talk about, you tried to separate out as much as you could people mm-hmm. who are those first-generation college students.
Yes.
They didn't have parents with that college mm-hmm. background. Mm-hmm. What did you learn about them?
So good news is that these students in this study, they are doing very well and are finished the education, and they most of them are gainfully employed and feeling pretty good about it. But I think students with ethnic minority background or mostly also first-gen students feeling less secure, less confident about their ability to manage money and also they're demonstrating lower self-efficacy. Even when there was no difference early on in their objective financial knowledge. So I think really self-efficacy is a skill set. It can be practiced and it can be learned. So I think we need to provide that mechanism for students to learn and practice and enhance their self-confidence.
So what would that mechanism be? How can students be given the opportunity to
sure.
practice that?
So firstly, like UW-Madison, since we started this study, we are offering financial life skill course for freshman, sophomore, for instance, what's important for that age group, and also financial life skill class for junior and seniors. So those classes are very important. We're not just focusing on knowledge. So knowledge is one thing, but translating the knowledge into actual behavior is another. So we are actually offering this class based on experiential learning opportunities and also financial skills that are relevant to today, what they're doing. For instance, how to get student loan? Why do you get a loan? How do you reduce the debt? And how to pay off? So things that are related to their life stage is very key to enhancing the self-efficacy.
How does this impact people's attitudes and happiness outside of the financial world if they try to take the bull by the horns, have this financial self-efficacy?
I think that happiness is a function of a number of things. If we can figure it out, it'll be great. But I think that we know about 50% of happiness is somewhat genetically related, and 10-20% is outside of our control. There's 40% that we can do something about. And two factors that are very important is planning horizon, and that is planning how far do you plan ahead. So those who plan ahead and sticking to the plan, and those two are very important factors for happiness.
Looking ahead, if you're able to, I know this is up in the air, if you're able to follow these millennials further out into their 30s, 40s, what would you be watching for?
So they are now about 60% of this cohort have committed relationships. Either some person, some small percentage of students are married, but many of them have a committed relationship. So we'll be looking at cohabitating and the influence on each other's financial behavior, and of course, how it's going to affect their financial planning after they make a long-term commitment. And we are interested in also how they are using their financial skills on raising their own children.
And then, are there key lessons? You've actually already touched on them. Are there a lot of lessons in what you've learned from the waves of students here mm-hmm. that we could be applying maybe to people graduating high school this summer?
Absolutely. And I think that parents and students and employers really focusing on this money management and really practical skills and having a purpose in what they do is important. So it doesn't happen overnight. It's a very slow developmental process. So we need to look at this as a long-term process, and whole community members, whether business organizations or community leaders, parents, schools, we need to work together to help students develop this financial capability, financial self-efficacy.
Soyeon, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Soyeon Shim is dean and a professor in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. She joined us to talk about the long-term A-plus study that's following how today's young adults find their path to well-being, in part through their financial knowledge and confidence. June marks National Soul Food Month, which celebrates a cuisine that combines food traditions of West Africa, Western Europe, and the Americas. Today on Food Friday, we're going to explore soul food's culinary tradition, its flavors, and the latest trends from vegan takes to fusion. Adrian Miller is a culinary historian, certified barbecue judge, and author of Soul Food, The Surprising Story of an American Cuisine, One Plate at a Time, and The President's Kitchen Cabinet, the story of the African Americans who have fed our first families from the Washingtons to the Obamas. Soul Food won the 2014 James Beard Foundation Book Award for reference and scholarship. Adrian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
I imagine there's a picture in everybody's mind when they hear the phrase soul food, but what is it?
Well, it's a lot of definitions, but soul food is the traditional food of African Americans, and it has a lot of overlap with Southern food. But essentially, you know, things like fried chicken, catfish, chitlins, greens, black eyed peas, candy jams, mac and cheese, and some kind of red drink and cornbread, and then a whole array of delicious desserts that I could go on forever.
And you've written and said elsewhere that in some ways it's an immigrant food in that it really took off as a concept when African Americans left the South in sort of this diaspora all over the country.
Yeah, so I wanted to reframe how people thought about soul food, because if you think about any immigrant cuisine in this country, we usually think about the celebration food of the old country. And soul food in many respects is a hybrid between everyday foods and the celebration food. And it really, really gained currency outside of the South. In fact, inside the South, they call it country cooking or just dinner. They don't really call it soul food.
What changed about those foods when it moved from the South around the country? What celebration foods that might have been that once or twice a year food or maybe once a week food became the highlights?
Yeah, so it's kind of an interesting convergence of technology and the emergence of our food system. So one perfect example is peach cobbler. So peach cobbler was something you only had when peaches were in season. But with the advent of canning technology, you could now have peaches anytime during the year. So peach cobbler goes from being a seasonal dessert to something that people have all year long. Another is fried chicken. Chickens were usually fried just in the spring. But again, with the agricultural system making chickens more widely available and cheap, fried chicken is something you could have any time of the week, but typically on a Sunday dinner.
Where did the term soul food come from?
Yeah, so actually the earliest joining of soul and food in the English language comes from Shakespeare's first play, the two gentlemen of Verona, and there's a scene where two women are talking about this hunky guy named Proteus, and one of the characters says, "Knowest thou not that his looks are my soul's food," which I thought is pretty hilarious. But over time, it usually meant something religious, like edifying your spiritual life by reading scriptures, sermons, and other things. But in the 1940s, it takes a musical term. So the term soul really described jazz artists who are African-American evoking the sounds and rhythms of the rural South, especially the black church in the rural South. So they called that musical style soul, and it quickly got slapped onto other aspects of black culture. So it was soul music, soul brother, soul sister, soul food.
But I could also see you've moved from, say, the South to an unfamiliar city in the maybe the Midwest here in Wisconsin, maybe, and having this food that you associate with home, it might be kind of a soul restorative, too.
Oh, absolutely. Because, again, like any other immigrant story, when you get to the new place, you do start to feel homesick. And so you try to recreate home, and food is a wonderful way to do that if you can get the exact same things. But if not, you find substitutes, you start borrowing from your neighbors. So you see kind of this changing of soul food over time as things get incorporated. And that's really the American food story, is about borrowing, learning, remixing, and creating something new.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to culinary historian Adrian Miller about soul food in the United States. And Adrian, I've written, you've busted some myths about soul food. And one you say is that soul food is inherently unhealthy.
Yeah, so that's one of the longest running disses on soul food. But if you take a look in what nutritionists are telling us to eat, more dark leafy greens, sweet potatoes, okra, hibiscus, more fish, these are all the building blocks of soul food. So my argument is it's a lot of it has to deal with how the food is prepared and how frequently you eat the celebration food.
I want to check out one of the recipes we've got posted, by the way, at WPR.org/Food Friday. It's from your book, Soul Food, from a fellow chef, a mac and cheese, Nyesha Arrington's mac and cheese. First, why is mac and cheese a part of the soul food repertoire?
Yeah, well, a lot of people don't know this, but mac and cheese was very popular in the United States before Italian immigrants arrived in large numbers, and it was extremely popular in the South. They actually called it macaroni pudding. So in a lot of big houses in the South, enslaved cooks who were African American were often charged with making this dish, and so after emancipation, it became one of those few dishes that was embraced, or I shouldn't say one of those few, but a dish that was embraced by African Americans, and it became a staple for special occasions and Sunday dinners. So much so that by the time you get to the 1960s and 70s, African Americans believed that they had invented mac and cheese, and white people were trying to steal it.
And what is special about this recipe from your cookbook? Is this the straight up mac and cheese, or is this a newer twist?
It's a newer twist because it's a different cheese, so it doesn't use cheddar. She uses a cheese that's a softer kind of melting cheese, and it just shows how mac and cheese has kind of a DIY vibe. As long as you can hold firm to kind of the framework, there's a lot of ways to play with mac and cheese. So I just wanted to give an interesting spin by a notable African-American chef.
Now let's talk about those greens, the turnip greens, and just a lot of other greens end up in these foods. And as a, you know, a home cook myself, I don't always know what to do with the greens, and I don't always like them the way I cook them anyway. What goes into them to make them awesome?
Yeah, so the key is to have good seasoning. Traditionally, greens were seasoned with some kind of meat, traditionally pork, typically ham hocks or hog jowl or something like that. More recently, people have started using smoked turkey as an alternative, or leaving meat out altogether and just making sure that the spices are well. But the trick is you just got to braise them slowly so that they're tender and you keep all of that good flavor.
Hey, speaking of the leaving the meat out, there is a trend there. I've seen a vegan and vegetarian soul food. What are we seeing here?
Yeah, so people freak out when I tell them that vegan is the hottest trend in soul food. That's where you're seeing a lot of creativity in the genre. So again, it's people moving away from pork or meat altogether. A lot of restaurateurs are using vegan side dishes because you can appeal to the largest customer base when you leave out the meat. Now, sadly, a lot of restaurants are not seasoning well, but the ones that are, you know, they're really hitting the right note. I remember getting a meal at a place called Solely Vegan in Oakland, California, and I had southern fried tofu, vegan mac and cheese, and vegan collard greens.
And how was it?
I have to tell you, the tofu, even though it was shaped to look like fried chicken, reminded me a lot of catfish, and I thought it tasted good.
So if they sold it as vegan catfish, it might have been better.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if people would have gone for that, though. I think marketing-wise, fried chicken's probably the way to go.
All right.
And the mac and cheese, I wasn't feeling so much because, you know, vegan has no dairy, and I think of mac and cheese as being creamy. And this was more the consistency of stuffed tortellini, if you've ever had that, kind of a cheese-filled tortellini. But, you know, it was decent. And the collard greens, I mean, they were as good as any I've had because they were well-seasoned.
Hey, speaking of the Bay Area, my brother lives out there, and he's nuts about this latest hipster trend of chicken and waffles shops. Well, yes. It's not really new at all. It's got a long soul food connection, right?
Absolutely. And this is another myth-busting thing. So the typical creation story for chicken and waffles is that it was started in Harlem in the 1920s and 30s as people were leaving the jazz clubs at 2 in the morning, too late for dinner, too early for breakfast. An entrepreneur decided to create this hybrid dish and sell it. His name was Joseph Wells, and Wells Chicken and Waffles lasted in Harlem for a long time. But chicken and waffles actually comes from old Europe. German immigrants who land in rural Pennsylvania brought a creamed chicken and waffle tradition with them. And that's really where it gets started in the late 1700s. And it's a high-end dish for a long time and falls out of favor in the early 1900s. And I think that created the space for this entrepreneur named Joseph Wells to create this hybrid dish and change the cream chicken into fried chicken. But you see chicken and waffles all over the place in Big House and Southern Plantation menus during the 1800s.
What's the key to a good chicken and waffle combo?
See, to me, it's a contrast in texture. So if you have a soft waffle, you want a really crunchy fried chicken and vice versa. And then you want a good seasoning on the fried chicken. And I actually put hot sauce on the fried chicken and then syrup on the waffle. But I know people that do it vice versa.
We're talking to Adrian Miller, culinary historian and author of several books, including Soul Food, The Surprising Story of American Cuisine, One Plate at a Time. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is soul food part of your family heritage? Or if not, have you gone to seek out soul food around Wisconsin, around the country? Do you have recipes that fit the bill you'd like to share with us, or questions for our guest about the past, present, maybe future of soul food? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. We've also posted a couple of recipes, some mac and cheese and hibiscus aid at WPR.org/Food Friday. It's Food Friday, and we're talking about soul food with Adrian Miller, author of Soul Food, The Surprising Story of an American Cuisine, One Plate at a Time, and The President's Kitchen Cabinet, the story of the African Americans who have fed our first families from the Washingtons to the Obamas. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is soul food a part of your life, a part of your family tradition? Is there a place you go for soul food in Wisconsin or when you go traveling elsewhere? Do you have a question for our guest? Call 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Adrian, another recipe. You talk about one element is red beverages, and that hibiscus aid we've got a recipe for fits the bill. Talk about the role of the red beverage in soul food.
Well, you have to understand that in soul food culture, red is a color and a flavor. So we don't get caught up in strawberry, cherry, or tropical punch. It's just red. And I believe that red Kool-Aid is the official soul food drink. And the reason I argue this is that two red drinks come from West Africa across the Atlantic during the slave trade era and take root in the Americas. So you probably have had both of them. One is cola. And cola nuts are white or reddish. And so typically a hospitality drink in West Africa was to put red cola nuts in water and sweeten to taste. And another is hibiscus. It's a plant native to West Africa. The flower petals are used to make a tea as well. In the Caribbean, it's called sorrel, and it takes root in Jamaica. But then it started to spread around Latin America. So if you go to a taqueria, it's called agua de Jamaica, Jamaica water. And all of these are riffs off West African drinks. And I think that sets the template for red drink, because if you look through newspaper accounts of any social gatherings from emancipation to the present, typically a red drink is present when a large number of African Americans get together.
And is this hibiscus aid pretty easy to pull together?
Oh yeah, very easy. All you need is, the hardest part is probably finding the hibiscus flowers, And usually any market that has Latino products, or Latinx, I think is the proper term now, products will usually have that. But once you get that, all you need is some water and some ginger and a sweetener to taste. And it's really easy and yummy.
Now, in your book, Soul Food, you address negative perceptions, sometimes racist stereotypes associated with certain aspects of soul food. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so soul food gets hit from two sides. So from the African-American side, it's believed that soul food is the food of the oppressor, the leftovers or the unwanted food of the master that black people are eating and literally digesting white superiority by loving this food. The other take is from the broader white society, in that this is low class food and that whites should not eat things that black people eat. So you see a lot of painful stereotypes emerge in the late 1800s using foods that even whites ate themselves, but to really demean the existence and humanity of African Americans. Typically, fried chicken and watermelon are chief among these painful stereotypes.
And how do you think about these things with those two negative views coming from very different perspectives?
Well, I think it's a chance to just really embrace these foods and understand the history, put it in context, and then celebrate it. I mean, fried chicken and watermelon are two of the most delicious things on the planet. So why be ashamed of that and take the sting out of it? To me, it's very similar to the conversation about the N-word. Now, I don't say the N-word, but the argument is that if you recontextualize it, it serves a different purpose. And I just think the same thing needs to happen for fried chicken and watermelon and all these other foods that have a painful stereotype. These are things that are wonderful to eat and should be celebrated. Acknowledge the pain that has come from the past, but reclaim it.
And there's a change going on. I think you've written about this elsewhere, where high-end restaurants are taking some elements of soul food that you wouldn't have seen in your fancier restaurants in the past and treating it as like a fancy new thing.
Yeah, now this is the thing that just cracks me up. So, you know, chief among these is the use of variety meats. And variety meats are those real funky cuts of meat that nobody wanted. So perfect example is pig's feet. So you go to a soul food joint, get some pig's feet. They're going to be less than $10. Your friends will probably tease you and ridicule you and ask you, why are you eating that? But then you go to a white tablecloth restaurant and pig's feet are called trotters. And now you're paying $30 for that same thing. And when you eat them, the experience is different. You're just amazed that the chef is honoring the whole animal and taking you to a place you've never been before with food. It's just killing me.
That's kind of a double-edged sword because, okay, these foods are getting respect and maybe these traditions are getting some respect. On the other hand, maybe the ingredients for people who have been making them all along are harder to find or more expensive.
Yeah, so that's the thing. You're just finding that a lot of prices for oxtails, pig's feet, ham hocks, you know, these things that were incredibly cheap are now expensive. So people are looking for alternatives now to season their vegetables. And we saw the same thing in the 1960s when soul food was extremely popular. There are newspaper articles talking about that. And believe it or not, a member of Congress, and I actually think he was from Milwaukee, looked into the price spikes in soul food. That's when your Congress was working for you, man.
We're talking to Adrian Miller, culinary historian. It is National Soul Food Month, and we're looking at the traditions and flavors of soul food. And Adrian, let's talk about flavors. What kind of spices tend to go into at least the savory dishes?
So the savory dishes are going to tend to have some kind of red pepper to really bring some heat. Garlic is very popular, and thyme, and really onion. When I cook soul food vegetables, that's kind of the trinity that I use, onion, garlic, and red pepper. And you tend to see that a lot. And then depending on the different dishes, some other spices may be involved. But that's the real core. There used to be a lot more salt in it. I don't cook with as much salt. And I would say that's probably another important seasoning as well. So nowadays when I cook, the salt I may get from the whatever smoked meat I'm using to season the vegetables.
Now, the people who brought soul food around the country moved all over the country. I imagine there's regional variation. What kind of differences are there from one, I don't know, state to another, maybe even one city to another?
So a lot of variation. So it really plays out in the type of fish that's popular. So along, say, like the Atlantic seaboard, you know, porgies and whiting is more popular. As you get more inland, then that's where you start to see catfish become more popular. Here out west, you see a lot of tilapia in soul food restaurants. Another variation is greens, along the Atlantic seaboard, you find a lot more kale before kale became really popular. And then you'll find collards in some place, mustard greens in some place, turnip greens in others, cabbage in others. And then the types of cornbread. Some places it's a skillet cornbread. You got a nice square or a wedge, or you may get a corn muffin or a corn cake or what we call hot water cornbread or corn sticks. And then the type of hot sauce that's preferred. Some places it's just a pepper vinegar. In other places, it's more the Louisiana-style hot sauce that we're more used to seeing in restaurants in different varieties. So you see a lot of things in the mix.
Oh, speaking of cornbread, sugar or no sugar?
Oh, man, sugar. Soulful cornbread has sugar. I know there are some Southerners that are saying, hey, when you put sugar in cornbread, it becomes cake. But I'm telling you, if you look at a cornbread recipe from an African-American, it's typically going to have some sugar in it.
And we mentioned the vegan and vegetarian options. What else is out there kind of on the frontiers of soul food that you are interested in, maybe excited about?
I love the fact that we're starting to see, and again, this is part of the American story. We're starting to see cultures play around and fuse soul food with their cuisines. So one thing you see a lot are soul food egg rolls called soul rolls. So it's an egg roll wrapper with mac and cheese in the inside, or collard greens, or maybe chicken and rice and gravy. And then another thing I've seen, a place called the Blaxican in Atlanta. That's the name of the place. The guy's doing things like collard green quesadillas, so kind of playing around and mixing different types of food cultures. And I just love to see it, as long as it has delicious results.
Now, this story, I mean, we've heard West Africa, the Caribbean, fusion with Mexican food, Pennsylvania Germans having a hand in all of this, and, of course, the American South. Is it fun just to trace the history of the influences blending back and forth?
Oh, absolutely. To me, food tells a story, and it's been fascinating to kind of follow people and see how their food changes as they encounter new environments and new neighbors. And to see how they, mix all of these things to survive, but also to just kind of have fun with their food and to explore new things. And I just think it's fascinating.
Adrian, in our last minute or so, I imagine you don't eat soul food for every meal, but do you have anything on the agenda on your menu for this weekend?
Yes. So I'm going to be I'm a certified barbecue judge, as you noted earlier. So I'm actually a celebrity judge for a local barbecue contest for first responders here in the Denver area. And my next book is going to be on the history of African-American barbecue culture. So I'm continually researching.
That sounds like really fun research.
Oh, yeah.
Adrian. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to announce my candidacy for the Soul Food Party in Wisconsin, but I don't know if you have one. So
not quite yet. Better get on the ballot quick, though. Adrian, thanks a lot for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
That's Adrian Miller, culinary historian, certified barbecue judge, acting barbecue judge this weekend, as we just heard. He's the author of Soul Food, The Surprising Story of an American Cuisine, One Plate at a Time, and The President's Kitchen Cabinet, the story of the African Americans who have fed our first families from the Washingtons to the Obamas. He joined us for a look at soul food during this edition of Food Friday. It is National Soul Food Month. Again, we have a couple of his recipes over at WPR.org/Food Friday. He shared a couple from the book Soul Food with us. You've got some mac and cheese there with a different twist on the cheese. I'm interested in that. And also that hibiscus aid, that hibiscus beverage you can check out. Again, find that at WPR.org/Food Friday. Depending on your age, that sound might be a mystery, a source of nostalgia, or maybe a source of dread if you aren't a great typist. It's a manual typewriter. And 150 years ago this weekend, a major patent was filed that helped put typewriters in offices and homes around the country. It was filed by an inventor from Milwaukee. Christopher Latham Scholes was a newspaper publisher, a politician, and an inventor. He moved to Milwaukee from Pennsylvania in 1837. He was one of a number of inventors around the country trying to perfect the typewriter for commercial use. A lot of his designs, his inventions, came into common use, including the key innovation, the modern QWERTY keyboard, where the letters at the top left are Q-W-E-R-T-Y and so on, that we still use today on the computer keyboard I'm looking down at right now. Now, I grew up at an age where I did do a couple early school papers on typewriters, and for a long time after, even as computers came into existence, had to use computers to fill out forms, applications, job applications, that sort of thing. I hated it. I don't miss the typewriter at all. We are spoiled by the existence of computers, and I wouldn't go back. Some people have a nostalgia. Paul Singer, a frequent guest on the show, is a typewriter fan. Let us know if you are nostalgic for the typewriter on a high-tech invention. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.